Good, we can get all those tracks. Excellent. So for this evening's sutta class, we're going to be looking at the Chataka Sutta, the six sets. Now, there are various problematic issues that could arise in the pronunciation of that title, and I hope to avoid them. Okay, so this particular discourse, as with all of the suttas in this chapter, is dealing mainly with the salayatana, the six senses. And this particular one looks at not-self in the context of the six senses. It has a number of parallels. The direct parallel in the Samyukta Agama from Sarvastivadin school, no doubt in the Salayatana Samyutta, and then a couple of other partial parallels, so similar suttas in the Salayatana Samyutta. And the note here is that this parallel here is that there's a series of short discourses, each of which has just one aspect of the sutta given in the Chataka Sutta. So in other words, it looks very much like you have probably the same sutta and you kind of split it up into bits and then you call it a bunch of different suttas. And the kind of the highly analytical and systematic style of some of these suttas lends itself to that kind of changes. Also a couple of Sanskrit fragments, as usual, the Sanskrit fragments from the Samyukta Agama would also be, I'm not sure if it's in Bamiyan, it might be Mahasangika. Usually these are Sarvasivan, Turfan, so a couple of, and a parallel also in Tibetan. There's also a reference to this sutta in the Abhidharma Kosha Bhashya, which refers to the title of the sutta. In that case, in the Sanskrit, the title is called the Shatshatko. Shatshatko. The Shatshatko Dharma Paryaya. And the Tibetan passage or Tibetan excerpt, as so often in these, is found in the Abhidharma Kosha Paikanama Tika. So this is as part of a collection of sutta passages which were referred to in the classical Abhidharma text, the Abhidharma Kosha. And it's something we've referred to a number of times, but what happened is that in around 400 and something, the great teacher Vasubandhu wrote his text, the Abhidharma Kosha, with his own commentary on it. And in that text, which was a summary of the entire Abhidharma system from the Sautrantika or Sarvastivadin Sautrantika point of view, he referred very frequently to the suttas, and usually just by referring to them by title or by quoting a short phrase or just by saying, you know, you should see it all as in the sutta or something. And then a few hundred years later, an author called Shamatadeva, if I remember correctly, collected all of the relevant sutta passages that were referred to and translated them all into one book. And that was then translated into Tibetan, and that's one of our main sources of the early suttas that we find in Tibetan, since they don't have the full early collections. But that, because the Abhidharma Kosha had a lot of references to suttas, and specifically it referred a lot to the more important ones and doctrinally significant ones, then there is a lot of very worthwhile text in that, as indeed the present example shows.
And when did you say that
Abhidharma Kosha Paikanama Tika?
Yeah, when were these two things When was it written and when was it translated into
Tibetan? I think it was roughly 7th, 8th centuries. I can't remember 100% the... exact textual details. Probably Inalio would discuss that more in his introduction and give more accurate data than I can give off the top of my head. Okay, so to the sutta. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Savatthi in Jeta's Grove and Atapindika's park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, Venerable Sir," they replied, "the Blessed One said this, 'Bhikkhus, I shall teach you the Dhamma that is good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end. With the right meaning and phrasing, I shall reveal a holy life that is utterly perfect and pure, that is the six sets of six. Listen and attend closely to what I shall say.' 'Yes, Bhante,' the bhikkhus replied, and the Blessed One said this." So this is a somewhat more elaborate introduction than we normally find in most of the Majjhima Nikaya suttas. Usually the Buddha just says, "I'll teach you the Dhamma, please listen and attend closely." Whereas here he's bringing in a standard phrase for the description of the Dhamma: beautiful in the beginning, beautiful in the middle, and beautiful in the end, Adi Kalyanam, and so on. And so it seems to be stressing the significance of the current discourse. He then goes on to give the synopsis, and as with so many texts in this current section, we have the classical formulae of the Uddesa Vibhanga, the summary and then the exposition, or as it says here, the synopsis and enumeration. Synopsis: the six internal bases should be understood, the six external bases should be understood, the six classes of consciousness should be understood, the six classes of contact should be understood, the six classes of feeling should be understood, the six classes of craving should be understood. Okay. So here we have a fairly thorough a description, not just of the ayatanas themselves, but also the contact, feeling, craving that comes off them. And notice the connection, how these are moving into dependent origination territory. And in dependent origination, you start out with ignorance and sankharas and so on, you go on to consciousness and so on, and then the six senses arise, leading to feeling and then craving and so on. And so this is looking... it can be understood as looking in more detail at that particular section of dependent origination. The Buddha then goes on with the enumeration, or the vibhanga. The six internal bases should be understood, so it was said, and with reference to what was this said, there are the eye base, the ear base, the nose base, the tongue base, the body base, and the mind base. So it was with reference to this that it was said the six internal bases should be understood. That's the first set of six. And so notice the use of the six sixes, so that's what the six sixes refers to, of course, is these six sets of six, and very useful as a mnemonic device. Yeah? You can remember, oh, hang on, I've got five of them. There's another one somewhere. Okay, so the six external bases should be understood: the form base, sound base, odor base, flavor base, the tangible base, and the mind object base. So there's reference to this, that it was said the six external bases should be understood. This is the second set of six. So of course that's just the objects of the senses. Next, the six classes of consciousness should be understood. So it was said, with reference to what was said, dependent on the eye and forms, eye consciousness arises. Dependent on the ear and sounds, ear consciousness arises. Dependent on the nose and odors, nose consciousness arises. Dependent on the tongue and flavors, tongue consciousness arises. Dependent on the body and tangibles, body consciousness arises. Depending on the mind and mind objects, mind consciousness arises. So it was with reference to this that it was said the six classes of consciousness should be understood. This is the third set of six. And so here, of course, the standard analysis of the arising of the six kinds of consciousness in dependence on the internal and external senses, and notice how with this exposition moves from a more or less straightforward statement of what there is the I and there is the forms and so on, and now we're moving to a statement of a relationship between them. Okay, so it's becoming more evolved or more complex, becoming richer as it moves along. It's not just listing the kinds of consciousness, but it's looking at the relationship between the consciousness and the former things that we've looked at. And so in this manner of exposition is not just a mode of teaching, but it's also a mode of meditation. And when you're developing a meditation, insight meditation on these things, this is also how you should move from seeing the simple things, the reality of the eye and the forms and the ear and the sounds and so on, towards deeper and deeper levels, seeing the connection between these things, how consciousness arises, and even more connections, as we're going to see later on in the sutta. Of course, it should go without saying, but probably does need to be said, that consciousness is always dependent. And I find myself continually be amazed by the lengths at which people bend over backwards to find unconditioned consciousness and all of these kinds of things in the Buddha's teachings, when the Buddha's clearly, he was at every possible opportunity was saying consciousness is dependent. Look at it. This is, where is this? It is unconditioned consciousness. It's all conditioned. So this is the ordinary everyday presentation of consciousness in the suttas. So the next one, the six classes of contact should be understood. So it was said, and with reference to what was this said, dependent on the eye and forms, eye consciousness arises. The meeting of the three is contact. Depending on the ear and sounds, ear consciousness arises. The meeting of the three is contact. Dependent on the nose and odors, nose consciousness arises. The meeting of the three is contact. Dependent on the tongue and the flavors, tongue consciousness arises. The meeting of the three is contact. Depending on the body and tangibles, body consciousness arises. The meeting of the three is contact. Depending on the mind and mind objects, mind consciousness arises. The meeting of the three is contact. So it was said with reference to that, that it was said the six classes of contact should be understood. This is the fourth set of six. Okay, so again, things becoming more complex as we're going on. We can easily enough understand what it is for, you know, to talk about the eye and sights and things like that. Eye consciousness, visual consciousness, yes, we can get, that's becoming much more subtle. But then this idea of contact, also becoming even more subtle still. And the phrase that it's using here is this. Dhyanam sangati paso, and the coming together, the sangati paso. And the reason I give you the Pali there is because I think the Pali in this case is quite interesting. It says that like, the coming together of the three, but the word here, gati, is from the root to go, and the sang is together, so sangati, almost literally like to going together or to rolling together. When they flow on together, something like that. So yes, it means that they come into one place at one time, but it's a functional or a dynamic state. It's not like a gati of they're all sitting down in the same room together, but it's a gati, is they're actually coming together. And so from this, which is the standard way that contact is talked about or passa is talked about in the suttas, it means it's just a word that's used when these three things are working together. Then you use the word contact, that there's these things happening. Curiously enough, the commentary glosses this by that. And you'll immediately recognize what the change of what's happened then. Exactly. No, that's not a verb. No, it looks like a verb, but no, it's not a verb. It's a noun. It's a nominative ending in I. Yeah. So it's derived from a verb, so it's a verbal sense, but grammatically it's a noun. Dhyanam sangati a paso. If it was a verb, it would be sanganti. But it's not. Yeah. So dhyanam sangati is the coming together of the three. The dhyanam sangati a means it's an ablative. From the coming together of the three is contact. Ah, it's quite a different kind of thing. And sorry?
Instrumental case.
Instrumental or ablative, yeah. Either one would have the similar sense in this case. Yeah, similar sense. So, Sinan Sangati Apaso is either from the coming together of the three, if you understand it as ablative, or due to the coming together of the three. if you understand it as instrumental. But in either case, pasa now becomes a separate, independent thing. Right? So you have the eye forms, eye consciousness, and then you have contact. So now you have four things. And so, of course, this is the tendency in later Buddhism, especially Abhidhamma Buddhism, is that everything became its own thing. So that there's a really, truly, woolly existing thing called contact. Right? Whereas according to the suttas, contact is more like a function. It's just like when these things are working, that's what happens. So contact is a word you use to describe what happens. And that's a tendency which you see very strongly throughout the Abhidhamma traditions in the Theravada, and even more so in the Sarvasivada, that things tended to become what they call reified, which means made into more sort of concrete entities rather than being processes or functions or aspects of things. Another example of that would be, for example, vinyati. Vinyati essentially means expression. So kaya vinyati is like a bodily expression, literally like you're waving at somebody or something like that is a kaya vinyati. You're making something known through your bodily expression. But that's also another thing, according to the Abhidhamma. It's like it's an ultimately existing entity. It's a bhava dhamma. Yeah. And there's many, many examples like that. So it's just important to understand the difference between the way the suttas present it and the way you tend to find things presented in the Abhidhamma. Okay. So then on from contact, it's coming to feeling. The six classes of feeling should be understood. So it was said with reference to what was this that dependent on the eye and forms. Eye consciousness arises. The meeting of the three is contact. With contact as a condition, there is feeling. Dependent on the ear and sounds, ear consciousness arises. The meeting of the three is contact. With contact as a condition, there is feeling. Dependent on the nose and odors, nose consciousness arises. The meaning of the three is contact. With contact as condition, there is feeling. Dependent on the tongue and flavors, tongue consciousness arises. The meaning of the three is contact. With contact as condition, there is feeling. Dependent on the body and tangibles, body consciousness arises. The meaning of the three is contact. With contact as condition, there is feeling. Dependent on the mind and mind objects, mind consciousness arises. The meaning of the three is contact. With contact as condition, there is feeling. So it was with reference to this that it was said the six classes of feeling should be understood. This is the fifth set of six. Yes, sir.
Going back to what you were saying about contact. As we're reading it here, I see the Abhidhamma viewpoint, but I don't see what you were saying about the root meaning. To get at the root meaning that you just pointed out, don't we need a different translation? Isn't it more of something like the meaning of the three are contacting or something like that, as opposed to it is contact.
Yeah.
This thing.
Yeah, I mean that's true, but that's not bridged linguistically and for a good reason. Actually, in the suttas, you find that the when they come to explain or define things, that they'll usually use a verb to define a noun, right? So if you want to say what is sanya, you say sanjanati iti sanya. It perceives, therefore it's perception. Or if you want to say what is vijnana, vijanati iti vijnana. Yeah? It cognizes, therefore it's cognizance. So that kind of way of understanding things is very fundamental in the suttas and is used very commonly. So you can always basically understand things in that way. So yes, you can always understand contact as being a function or a process rather than being a thing. But there is a reason for why they are expressed as nouns in this section of the of this discourse. And this is something that's what's brought out very beautifully in the Madhupindika Sutta. Because in the Madhupindika Sutta, it starts out with the same sequence, and then it goes up to depending on contact, there's feeling. And then when it goes on to young, and then it says from feeling, yang vedeti, tang sanjanati, what one feels, that one perceives. So it starts the verbs there. What one perceives, that one thinks about. Yang sanjanati, tang vitaketi. So you start out with nouns, but as the process builds up speed, you're starting to, and it becomes more complex, then it becomes more verbified, you become caught up in it. And then after vitaketi, young vitaketi, tanka pancheti, you proliferate. And what you proliferate overwhelms a person with regards to dhammas from the past, present and future. Yeah, so you sort of, that whole process builds up pace, and then at the end of it, you have a person, which you didn't have to start with, and you have the past, present and future, which you didn't have to start with, and you're swept over by these dhammas. Yeah? So this is the point of the reason why this is expressed in nouns rather than verbs is in a sense it's more like an automatic process rather than being a process which is actually actively done. And so the initial stages of sense cognition, when you get you hear something, and that happens pretty much automatically. Yeah, but then your decision to then you, when if you start to th- react to it and start to think about it and proliferate about it, then that's something that you're actually more doing. So there's that, and I think that shift is kind of expressed in the grammar in the Madhupindika Sutta and a few other places.
Being caught up in it,
yeah, swept away. I think it uses anu like from the root sav, to be swept away, like the.
You don't know
what you're doing, exactly, yeah.
So where do we have tenan, sangati, so this coming together, this flowing together, that's not...
Yeah, that's what Bhikkhu Bodhi translates, the meeting of the freest contact.
Meeting of the free.
Yeah. Mm. Meeting of the free. There's nothing wrong with the translation. You can translate sangati as
meeting.
Yeah, it does mean meeting, but it has that sense of like going together.
I know.
I'm not suggesting it be translated that, but it's just a connotation. Yeah. So it's like if it's a bit like say in English you might say, we processed, you know, or something like that. It has a more active feeling than if you say when we sat, we processed. Anyway.
But the Abhidhamma is justified in saying, well, okay, you know, the meeting of the three is...
No. What the sutta says is these three things come together, that's contact. What the Abhidhamma says is when these three come together, this is born, and that's another thing. And that's contact. Yeah? So that's the difference.
We're hearing it on the recording.
There's a glass here, subtitle. The glass got born from my three fingers.
It's like we got air, water, and some other little rainbow. Rainbow really a different thing, or is it really just the light, the air, and the water? It all comes together because the rainbow doesn't really exist. It's just water and
the light. Yeah. It's an interesting metaphor. I'm not quite sure how to answer that, yeah. Anyway, moving right along. Okay. The six classes of craving should be understood. So once more, we continue, the whole thing becomes more developed, reaching up to the stage of craving independent origination. Dependent on eye and forms, eye consciousness arises, the meeting of the three is contact, with contact the condition is feeling, with feeling is condition is craving. Depending on the ear and sounds, nose and odours, tongue and flavours, body and tangibles, mind and mind objects, mind consciousness arises, the meeting of the three is contact, with contact is condition is feeling, with feeling is condition is craving. So it was with reference to this that it was said the six classes of craving should be understood. This is the sixth set of six. Okay, so that's the basic exposition of the six sixes. And I'll just pop over and have a look at the comparative study and see what we have here from Venerable Ananya's analysis. Okay, so all of the parallels include the introduction where the Buddha says that this teaching is good in the beginning, middle and end. And this is somewhat unusual in the Pali discourse, Pali discourses, because usually that phrase only occurs as a description of the Dhamma in general, but not as an introduction to a sutta. In the Chinese Agamas, however, the same passage acts as an introductory passage on other occasions as well. The Chachaka Sutta and its parallels take up six sets of sixes as the basis of their exposition, which are the six senses, six sense objects, six kinds of consciousness, six kinds of contact, six kinds of feeling, six kinds of craving. Three versions examine the not-self nature of all these aspects of experience in similar terms, explaining that since they're impermanent, to identify them as a self would imply that the self arises and passes away. Okay. Okay, so the next bit is now talking about the next part of the sutta, so I'll leave that aside and go on and read the sutta. Back to the sutra again. So then we go on to apply the basic exposition that we've looked at previously to the understanding of not-self. Now again, notice how the structure of this. This sutta is almost like an exemplary display of how to go about vipassana meditation. We started out with analyzing or looking at those things that are very simple and immediate and present, the eye and the forms and these things which are the most, which make up our experience in the most immediate way. Gradually, we're looking more and more at the complexity of that process, the consciousness that arises there, the contact, the way these things always work together, the way that they don't just sit there, but they lead on to other things, feeling and craving and so on. And so that whole analysis that we've read up to so far of the six sixes is talking about a development, a deepening of vipassana meditation into the six senses. And now, at this stage, is moving to an even deeper level of the vipassana meditation, is the understanding in terms of not-self. The not-self understanding of things is implicit in the previous analysis, but is now being made explicit. So this form that the meditation is following follows along with the three kinds of parinya, which the commentaries talk about very frequently, and the forgive my lack of criticals. Tirana, I think it's, isn't it, Tirana Parinya, something like that. And then the that's the second one, I think. First one is the Nyata Parinya, I think. I hope I've got the names right. Names don't matter too much, and then the final one is the Pahana Parinya. And I've mentioned these a number of times in these sutta classes, but this is, to my mind, this is the most useful very sort of brief analysis of how insight happens, or the course of insight. And even though this particular framework is mentioned explicitly only in the commentaries, as we see with the current sutta, it's actually implicit in the structure of the sutra. It's one of the cases where the commentaries have kind of abstracted a general course of things from the principles found very frequently in suttas, but not formulated as such through scrutiny. And you can read about these in more detail in the Visuddhimagga and so what these refer to is three stages in developing vipassana meditation. Parinya is full understanding. Nyata means what's known. And so the Nyata Parinya is that first stage that we've seen in the Chachaka Sutta, is the knowing what there is, knowing that the eye is there, that the forms are there. It's looking directly at what is in front of you and seeing and perceiving directly what you experience. The Tirana Parinya is a scrutiny in terms of anicca dukkha anatta, impermanent suffering and not self. So this is what we're moving towards now in the Chachaka Sutta, is the Tirana Parinya, is looking at how, once we've known clearly what's there, then we can start to analyze that in terms of not self. Okay, so that analysis, notice it's not a completely different thing. It's already emerging from that first one. We've already had that the idea of conditionality has already been implied or part of the first one. But now it's becoming foremost, it's becoming the most important thing is the not self. And then finally pahana parinya, this full understanding by abandoning, of course, is the realization of awakening, is where the full understanding comes to fruition. So this is really useful and something which I think is sometimes overlooked in descriptions of vipassana meditation. When we describe vipassana meditation as contemplation of impermanence, in a sense, yes, of course, that's perfectly true, but it's not necessarily useful to just start out by just meditating and saying this is impermanent and that's impermanent and so on and so forth. You need to look more clearly and exactly at what there is that is impermanent and what there is that's suffering and what there is that's anatta. And that's this stage of jnata parinya. And so notice that jnata parinya, these also line up quite neatly with the different kinds of anumana or ways of knowing that I've talked about also in a number of sutta classes. And so this is the pratyaksha. This is the direct knowing. So this is how you know that, right? So you see, you know that this cup is there by looking at it, right? No one's going to tell you that it's there. You don't have to infer anything like that. You just know that it's there. And then the second kind of pamana is the pratyaksha. How do they call it? They call it anvaya. No, anumana. I think they use anumana is the usual word they use. So anumana is the through inference. So the understanding of the three characteristics, and this is something also which I think is often misunderstood. The understanding of the three characteristics is primarily known through inference, and at a deep level is always known through inference. And people very often think, oh, vipassana meditation is always just jnata parinya. It's just you see what's there, but you can't see sabbe sankhara dukkha. All conditions are suffering, because you can't see all conditions. All you can see is this condition. You can't directly see all conditions. You can only see the condition that's actually present at that time. You can't actually see that everything's impermanent. In fact, you can't actually directly see impermanence at all, because impermanence is a process that happens over time. That's the whole point of impermanence. It happens over time. You can only see the present. I can't see the non-existence of this cup in the future and the past. I can only see what's present at the moment. Yeah, then I drop it. Then I see it hitting the ground.
Then it has a ventilator.
So?
It's not the same.
I can infer that it's not the same because my memory tells me that it was different before. But I can't see that.
If you only experience and you don't remember it.
Imagine if you didn't remember anything, yeah? Then you couldn't ever see impermanence. Yeah, everything is just as it is. So understanding these, yeah, you base it on jnata parinya, so you have a very strong knowledge of what there is. Again, this if you think of it like a scientist working, first thing the scientist does is they gather data. That's what jnata parinya is gathering data, getting the facts straight. Yeah, then tirana parinya, then the scientist will try to explain that data, okay, to try to make generalizations that enable you to understand the data as a whole. And the pahana parinya, you get the Nobel Prize. Okay, so if anyone says the I is self, that's not tenable. The I, the rise and the fall of the I are discerned, and since its rise and fall are discerned, it would follow myself rises and falls. That is why it's not tenable for anyone to say the I is self, therefore the I is not self. If anyone says forms are self, that's not tenable. The rise and the fall of the forms are discerned, and since the rise and fall of the forms are discerned, it would follow myself rises and falls. That's why it's not tenable for anyone to say the forms are the self. Thus, forms are not self. Thus, the I is not self and forms are not self. And then similar analysis is then continued on through the other aspects through to craving, and then followed through for the other senses. And again, the fact that it's a fully spelt out. Also, this is also part of the instructions for Vipassana meditation. In fact, probably I would say that of all the suttas in the Pali canon, this particular sutta is probably the best instructions on Vipassana meditation that you find anywhere. It's very, very clear, very straightforward, laid out, and very systematic. So, so when you systematically go through all of those things, and of course, in this case, is your because of your scrutiny, your tirana. So notice how it's explicitly using this kind of inference, this anumana. Inference, pataksha is direct perception. So you're using that inference to know that to connect anicca and dukkha. Sorry, in this case, anicca and anatta. Yeah, and so these here the three characteristics are being linked up as they are in various ways in the canon.
So I'm interested here, it's also very clear in the way that Bhikkhusides define that the Jiva Tattva is, you know, like the indivisible immortal soul Tattva.
Right.
Quite clearly.
Very clearly, yeah, yeah. And this, in Indian philosophy, this is usually, there's a very strong link between existence and eternity. Something which really, truly, woolly exists must exist forever. You find actually, I think we talked about that tendency in Plato and so on, where the more absolute that something exists, then the more eternal it is. So that the self is always felt to be eternal. And so again, this is why the Buddha emphasized this very empirical method of meditation, where you're just looking at what actually you perceive as being primary, and not your ideas about things as being primary. Okay, so now bhikkhus, this is the way leading to the origination of personality. Okay, so the word for personality here is sakkaya. I think. Should I double check that? Yeah, sakkaya is the origination of sakkaya. So literally, sakkaya is real body.
Body plus.
Okay, now bhikkhus, of course, not meant to be interpreted literally here, it means personality, or probably better, a Bhikkhu Bodhi later used identity instead of personality is probably a better translation. When regards to I thus, this is mine, this I am, this is myself. When regards form thus, this, when regards eye consciousness, eye contact, feeling and craving, this is mine, this I am, this is myself. And similarly for the ear, and so on and so forth through the six sets. And how does the cessation of personality come? One regards the I thus, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself, forms and so on and so forth through all of the different permutations. So this again, this is very important. The idea of self is not something which is just given. And this is really important to understand. The idea of self is something which is constructed. It's something that we do. Right? It's not something innate. You don't have to do it. Right? It's something that we do every time we have a sense experience, anything happens, and we relate to that in that way, identifying with it, attaching to it, rejecting it, all of those things. In that moment, in every moment of our sense experience, we are constructing the self. Yeah? And if you take that apart, by undoing each of those things, this is not mine, this is I'm not, each time you do that, you're deconstructing the self. Very important to understand this, because this idea of not self is sometimes, you know, it's obviously a very complex thing, and sometimes seems to be too kind of exalted to get a grip of what it actually means. But if we understand that at every sense moment, every sense consciousness, we are building ourself, we're actively doing it, it's what we do. Yeah? Sankharas, thinking. Yeah, me, mine, I want, yeah?
Yeah.
Attachments, feelings, emotions. You're actively doing that all the time. And it's a lot of work.
You work with the idea about one chair and other people.
Yes.
And you can easily.
And it's exhausting.
That's really terrible.
If you're sleeping, well, you're not doing it so much. Well, kind of. Yes. Yeah, kind of. Yeah, he's still existing.
I don't remember that he existed.
Shankaroti in your Pali or Shankaroti. Constructing.
Constructing, yeah. Yeah, building work. The inner Patrick. Okay. Underlying tendencies. Ooh, okay, depending on the eye and forms. Eye consciousness arises. Meaning of the three is contact with contact. There is a feeling felt as pleasant or painful, or neither painful nor pleasant. Ah, so now we're going into more detail. Again, notice how this whole thing, you're going over the same ground again and again and again, deeper and deeper, and finding new nuances in it. Pleasant or painful, or neither painful nor pleasant. When one's touched by the pleasant feeling, if one delights in it, welcomes it, remains holding to it, then the underlying tendency to lust lies within one. When one's touched by painful feeling, if one sorrows, grieves and laments, weeps, beating one's breast and becoming distraught, then the underlying tendency to aversion lies within one. When one is touched by a neither painful nor pleasant feeling, if one does not understand as it actually is, the origination, the disappearance, the gratification, the danger and the escape, in regard to that feeling, then the underlying tendency to ignorance lies within one. Because that one shall here and now make an ending of suffering without abandoning the underlying tendency to lust for pleasant feeling, without abolishing the underlying tendency to aversion towards painful feeling, without extirpating, digging out the underlying tendency to ignorance in regard to neutral, to neither painful nor pleasant feeling, without abandoning ignorance and arousing true knowledge, this is impossible. And then it repeats the same for all of the six sixes. Now, again, getting even more complex and more powerful as the analysis goes. Here we've analysed the three kinds of feelings and then the three kinds of responses to it. Also a wonderful topic for Vipassana meditation, yeah? So when we're contemplating feelings, again, we follow the same pattern that we've looked at before. The first one is know what they are. So first of all, oh yeah, they're feelings. And then you go in and you see, okay, a bit more detail that will be pleasant, painful or neutral feelings. And this is the jnata parinya. Then as you go deeper into that, you begin to see, how do I respond to those feelings? When I have a pleasant feeling, what happens? How does my mind move towards that? When I have a painful feeling, how does my mind move away from that? When I have a neutral feeling, how does my mind get bored and disinterested and fall asleep and not pay attention to that? Okay, and then here we're moving into the dhirana parinya, is the deeper understanding by understanding the nature of things through an inference or through understanding the general principles of them.
Patterns of reaction.
Yeah, conditioned behavior.
Yeah, the conditioning.
Yeah, yeah. So this one's very important to notice how, of course, these three tendencies, the painful, pleasant, and neutral feeling, are correlated with the three basic roots of defilements, the greed, hatred, and delusion. So pleasant feelings associated with greed, unpleasant feeling associated with hatred, and neutral feeling is associated with delusion, okay, and unknowing, okay. So, and of course, the most interesting one and the most powerful one is the last one, is delusion, because it's when that unknowing can be flipped around and become true knowing, then that neutral feeling is no longer associated with delusion, because you're falling asleep and being uninterested, but it's associated with true insight, because you're seeing things clearly without pushing them and distorting them. The pain and pleasure always distort things. So if you see it completely neutrally, you see it as it is. Okay, I'll come back to the I'll finish this one, the abandonment of the underlying tendencies first. Dependent on the eye and forms, eye consciousness arises, the meeting of the three is contact, with contact as conditioned as feeling, felt as pleasant or painful, or neither painful nor pleasant. When one is touched by a pleasant feeling, if one does not delight in it, welcome it, and remain holding to it, then the underlying tendency to lust does not lie within one. When one is touched by a painful feeling, if one does not sorrow, grieve, and lament, does not weep, beating one's breast, and become distraught, then the underlying tendency to aversion does not lie within one. When one is touched by a neither painful nor pleasant feeling, if one understands that it actually is the origination, the disappearance, the gratification, the danger, and the escape in regard to that feeling, then the underlying tendency to ignorance does not lie within one. Because that one shall here and now make an end of suffering by abandoning the underlying tendency to lust for pleasant feeling, by abolishing the underlying tendency to aversion towards painful feeling, and by extirpating or digging out the underlying tendency to ignorance in regard to neither painful nor pleasant feeling, by abandoning ignorance and arousing true knowledge, this is possible. And the same for the other sense bases. Seeing thus, because a well-taught, noble disciple becomes disenchanted, nibbida, as we discussed the other day, with the eye, with forms, with eye consciousness, eye contact, feeling, and craving. He becomes disenchanted with the ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, mind objects, mind consciousness, mind contact, disenchanted with feeling, disenchanted with craving, being disenchanted or disgusted, perhaps, or repulsed. He becomes dispassionate. Through dispassion, his mind is liberated. When it's liberated, it comes to knowledge. It is liberated. He understands birth is destroyed. The holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming to any state of being. This is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. Now, while this discourse was being spoken, through not clinging, the minds of 60 bhikkhus were liberated from the defilements. Yeah. Okay, so coming over to the comparative study.
Can I see the Pali of the upper paragraph, the life energy, not life, after downward translation?
The underlying tendency part?
Not further.
Maybe it's 30 here. Which passage? So Sukhaya Vedana Putto, when he's touched by pleasant feeling, he delights and grabs and hold of it. Ajosaya Titari, yeah. That's a Raga Anusayo Anuseti.
The translation are not very accurate.
Which one is this? Is the touched by pleasant feeling, one delights in it, welcomes it, and remains holding to it. Remains holding? I think that's okay. Kitati? That's what remains, it says remains holding.
It
means what?
Repossess.
I don't understand.
Repossess.
With banking?
Deposit.
Deposit?
Yeah.
It means depositing?
Yeah.
Depositing what? No, titity means to stand, not to deposit. He remains holding to it. Perhaps remains is, perhaps would be he stays holding, stands holding it. Anyway, that's what the Pali is. Okay, so to the comparative study. Now, regarding the analysis of the not-self nature of these aspects of experience, one difference is that the Pali and Tibetan versions apply the treatment or the analysis of not-self to craving. While the Samyukta Agama discourse agrees, so that's this one here, this one agrees with the other versions on including craving in the earlier listing of the six sets of sixes, it does not take up the possibility that craving could be identified as a self. The Samyukta Agama version concludes by indicating that contemplating as devoid of self, the three types of feeling arising dependent on the senses, leads to Nibbana. The Pali version approaches the same topic in a different manner as it contrasts the path leading to the arising of personality or identity by identifying with these aspects of experience with the path leading to the cessation of identity. The Chachaka Sutta continues by giving a more detailed treatment to the three types of feeling, depicting how a pleasant feeling leads to attachment and painful feeling to aversion, while with neutral feeling its advantage is disadvantage and the escape from it is ignored. Only by going beyond these unwholesome reactions and the corresponding underlying tendencies can liberation be attained. So that that whole thing on the identity is unique to the Pali version. As always with these things, is that you'll find similar passages in other places in the Chinese suttas, but there just doesn't happen to be in this particular one. While the Tibetan version does not refer to the theme of personality, it takes up the three types of feeling for a similar treatment. The Tibetan version concludes its exposition by indicating the contemplation of the not-self nature of all aspects of sense experience up to the three types of feeling leads to nirvana, thereby parallels the exposition given at the end of the Chinese version. All of the versions conclude with the delight of the bhikkhus, and the Pali notes that 60 bhikkhus reach the ending of the defilements while listening to this exposition. So the 60 bhikkhus becoming arahants is only in the Pali version, obviously because the Pali is better.
In that case,
probably, yeah. I mean, I think what it does indicate is that, what you see with that, you could even suspect that with the very fact that in the Pali it's in Majjhima, whereas in the others it's in the Sangyutta. So in other words, in the Chinese and in the Sarvastivadin, it was one of 100 suttas dealing with this topic, collected in the Sangyutta Nikaya. So it's, important, but nothing particularly special. Whereas in the Theravada tradition, it was taken out of the Sangyutta and made a whole Majjhima Nikaya Sutta all by itself. It seems with the addition of some of those other passages, especially analysing not-self, and of course these all being the specialist doctrines of the Theravada, the detailed analysis of our perceptual experience is very characteristic of Theravada, and also the emphasis on not-self. Of course, all of the schools of Buddhism had the idea of not-self, but it was one of the defining teachings of Theravada was the analysis of not-self as propounded by Moggaliputta, the first and by far the longest of the discussions in the Katawattu. So probably I would read that particular shift in this case as being due to the sectarian development in the Theravada to emphasize the importance of the perceptual process and to emphasize and understanding that as not-self. Although I don't think that in this case, I don't think it's introducing any new ideas. I just think it's more emphasizing that particular aspect of the old ideas as opposed to the other versions, which in this case is somewhat less emphasized.
Then if you were to use this as a guide, as you suggested, would you cut out those parts that might have been put?
No. Not necessarily. I mean, I think they're all I don't think there's anything. They're all things that are found many times in the suttas, and as I said, that pattern of way of doing things is, I think, very common actually in a lot of the longer discourses on dealing with vipassana topics. So. Dhammanupassana, yeah.
In all of those, the 60 monks got invited, or is there...
No, only the Pali.
Only Pali.
Mm. That's why I said this, because the Pali's better. Okay, so...
do you want to go over what it means to... Probably already have, I'm not sure, but over what it means to understanding the origination, the disappearance, the injury, the escape.
Okay.
Gratification.
Yeah, sure. Okay, so this is the passage here. Which is one of the stock passages in the suttas. If one does not understand as it actually is the origination, the disappearance, the gratification, the danger, and the escape. So this is five aspects with regard to everything, and when one understands those five aspects, one's said to have fully understood something. Yeah? So the origination, what is the cause of something, where does it come from? Yeah. So in this particular case, then you can understand the origination of feeling, with the eye and the forms and these kinds of things, and then giving rise to the feeling and so on. So this, you're looking at what is the origination of it. The disappearance of it is when something passes away, so when those conditions for something to be there are not there anymore, then there's the ending of it. The gratification, what is it that we like about it? What is it that's actually pleasant about it? So obviously that's in different ways can be experienced. Yeah, asada, the sweet taste of something. Yeah? So most... Sorry?
Good flavour.
Good flavour, yeah. Yeah, so most obviously is when you have pleasant feeling, then you get a gratification for something. But it's not just pleasant feeling. You can be gratified sometimes by a neutral feeling, can be very gratifying in some cases. Even painful feeling can be gratifying in some cases.
Indulgence.
What's that?
Indulgence.
Indulgence?
Yeah.
Something like that, yeah. So what do you get out of it? You know, and it's not just feeling also which gives gratification. Knowledge can give gratification. Perception can give gratification, and so on. So what is the advantage of something? What is the positive side of something? The danger is saying, well, what's the negative side of it? Yeah? What does it lead to? What's the downside of it? And then the escape, of course, being the letting go of it, the not having attachment for it, not being trapped by it. So I think this is actually really kind of important in showing that the whole kind of scope of the full understanding of something. Again, notice how that's not different to the threefold parinya that I talked about before. So you see the origin and disappearance of something is under the nyata parinya. Gratification and the danger can be understood here under the tirana parinya. Yeah, for example, that, you know, if you have a pleasant feeling, then the danger in that is the fact that it's going to be impermanent. So that's understanding in terms of impermanence. And then, of course, the escape from it is the same as the understanding by abandoning. So this is why I say with this kind of pattern, when you understand this pattern, you can recognize it again and again in the way that the suttas talk about the development of wisdom, the development of understanding. And to me, this is one of the very beautiful things about the suttas, is that even though... They present things in ways that might be very different in different contexts. If you understand the principles that underlie it, you can see these patterns and this commonality, and you realize that there's a common wisdom which is underlying all of these different things. So maybe we should finish up there. We'll see how we go.